Part 1. Internal Evidence for God. Chapter 1. The Desperate Dilemma.
Can we live without God? Many atheists appear to be doing just fine without Him. In fact, I have some atheistic friends who have told me that they are perfectly content with life apart from God. While it's possible that they could be lying, it doesn't seem like it. As far as I can tell, they live moral lives, love their friends and family, and appear to have a general sense of meaning and purpose in their lives. In fact, they seem to be entirely content with their lives. Yet a certain tension of which they are unaware plagues them. While they are content in their atheistic worldview, they are not consistent with it. Put another way, while it's possible to be an atheist who is content in life, it's impossible to be content with a consistent atheistic worldview. Is this really true? If God is truly dead, would contentment die with Him? Let's look at a number of aspects of life that would crumble if God were not around to support them. Number 1. Significance. If God doesn't exist, is it possible to have a life that is ultimately significant? Unfortunately, it isn't. While we might feel like our lives are significant, ultimately, they aren't. To help understand this concept, consider this math problem. 21 plus 52 minus 108 plus 231 minus 35 plus 675, all multiplied by 0. This is a frustrating problem to work through, especially once you reach the end. After all of that work of adding and subtracting, you come to find that it was all multiplied by 0. What a waste of time! We could add 100 more numbers, and it wouldn't make any difference in the end whatsoever. And yet, when you think about it, this is also true of humanity, either individually as persons or collectively as a species. Physicists tell us that the universe is going to end in heat death. All of the usable energy in our universe will eventually burn out. No matter how we live our lives, we are doomed to private death as individuals and collective extinction as a species. This isn't a probability, it's a certainty. No matter what we do with our lives, we will face the unavoidable conclusion of death. Given this fact, from the atheistic perspective, there is no ultimate significance to life. As atheist Jean-Paul Sartre writes, "Thus it amounts to the same thing whether one gets drunk alone or is the leader of nations." Now someone might say, "Wait a minute, my life has significance because I affected a lot of people and made a difference in their lives." While this may be true, it only shows a relative impact on others, not an ultimate one. Eventually, the tides of time will wipe our impact clean off the face of the earth. In the classic rock song, That's the Way, Led Zeppelin's lead singer Robert Plant sings, "And yesterday I saw you kissing tiny flowers, but all that lives is born to die. And so I say to you that nothing really matters, and all you do is stand and cry." If all that lives is born to die, then Plant is right. Nothing really matters. If we really comprehend the gravity of a universe without God, then we really can't blame the girl for standing and crying in a universe doomed to death. This concept became real to me several years ago when I sat with my elderly grandfather in his basement. He showed me black and white pictures of our family from the 1930s. My grandfather was just a little boy in the photos, which would give you an idea of how old they were. He asked if I recognized any of the people in the photographs. I told him I didn't. "What about him?" he asked, pointing his aged finger at one of the pictures. I shrugged my shoulders. "What about her?" he asked. Again, I shook my head. Finally, he said, "What about this guy?" I had no idea who the man was. "That's your great-grandfather," he exclaimed. None of the pictures were very interesting to me. They were all dead people whom I never met. They were very important to my grandfather, but not to me. As I sat staring at the photographs, a sudden realization flooded into my mind. Not only was I unable to recognize my great-grandfather in a lineup, I didn't even know the man's first name. But consider how significant this man's life was to my own existence. If he hadn't lived, then I wouldn't be alive. Yet his significance is already beginning to fade, even to me, someone who should be largely aware of his importance. Likewise, in the not-so-distant future, no one will be able to recognize you or me in a photograph. Our lives' work will be erased from the face of the earth in 50 or 100 years, or perhaps 200 if we're lucky. If the Christian God is real, then we have the hope of eternity. Death is not the end, only the beginning. But if God is dead, then any ultimate significance dies with him. Number 2. Equality. Can human equality exist in a universe without God? When you think about it, human beings are obviously not all equal. This might be surprising to read, particularly to the 21st century reader, but it's verifiably true. For instance, Stephen Hawking is not intellectually equal with LeBron James, and LeBron James is not athletically equal with Stephen Hawking. These men are both human, but they are not both equal. If these men were truly equal, then Stephen Hawking should have an equal opportunity in trying out for the NBA, and LeBron James should have just as much of a chance publishing popular books on astrophysics. Clearly, this isn't the case. So in what sense are these two men equal? It's easy to affirm that 10 dimes equals $1, or 6 cans of beer is equal to a 6-pack of beer. But how can we claim that these two men are equal with one another when they obviously are not? Atheist Ayn Rand admits, "Egalitarianism, equality, is so evil and so silly a doctrine that it deserves no serious study or discussion." If there is no God, then Rand is right. We simply have no basis for claiming that all people are equal when it's abundantly clear that they're not. Someone might say, "Stephen Hawking and LeBron James both have things in common." Yes, this is true. They both have 2 arms, 2 legs, and 1 belly button. But these similarities don't make them equal. A Porsche and a Toyota Corolla have things in common. They have 4 wheels and 1 engine. But they are not equal cars. If you disagree, then I'd like to offer you a trade. If people are objectively equal, then we need to have something in common that is both objectively true and truly important. The fact that both have 2 lungs and 1 heart is objectively true, but it is not truly important. Body parts are not important enough foundations to establish equality. If they were, then men and women would technically be unequal with one another, because they don't have the same body parts. Likewise, a kidney donor would not be equal to someone with 2 kidneys. Obviously, body parts are not a strong enough foundation for equality. Of course, if the Christian God exists, and all humans are made in his image, as the Bible teaches, then this would be both objectively true and truly important. On the other hand, if God does not exist, then human beings would hold nothing in common that could make them truly equal. Number 3. Morality. If there is no God, is it possible to have objective morality? Of course, if God doesn't exist, human beings would still continue to have subjective moral feelings and beliefs. In fact, I'm sure that societies would still continue to have socially constructed rules and laws, promoting cooperative behavior or enforcing social taboos. But would anything be objectively moral or immoral? I can't see how. This might shock you to hear, but most atheistic thinkers would agree. Think about it from their perspective. The Big Bang was a non-moral first cause to the universe, an explosion in the vacuum of space. There is nothing moral or immoral about explosions. If God does not exist, then it was simply chance and luck that humans evolved from a lower species to a higher one. This was a non-moral process. If there is no God, then the same blind cosmic machine that evolved the fungus on our feet also produced our family members. Nature does not in any way differentiate between the life forms it creates, nor does it care about them or value them. Here then is an important question. How does a non-moral first cause and a non-moral process ever create a moral product? Or put another way, how can a non-moral beginning and a non-moral middle ever produce a moral end? Amoral and impersonal causes are not capable of producing morality, unless there is a moral standard outside of this naturalistic process. If God doesn't exist, is the foundation for moral values, then objective morality is just an illusion that we've invented in a morally numb universe of matter, motion, and energy. Have you ever watched the Nature Channel? It's actually one of the most violent channels on television, and it's all real blood and guts, too. The Nature Channel will often show a lion stalking a gazelle on the plains of the Serengeti. The lion chases down the gazelle, pounces on it, sinks its teeth into its throat, and rips out its jugular. Blood flies everywhere. The gazelle goes limp and lifeless as the lion feasts on its dead body. Even though this is gruesome, I doubt many people are offended at the violence on the Nature Channel. I doubt any overprotective mothers write to the producers of the show, protesting the violent images. No one is offended at this, because this is only nature. It's only natural for a lion to kill a gazelle. We don't expect anything different. No one would watch the lion attacking the gazelle, gasp in horror and cry, "You murderer!" However, we would react this way if someone broke into our house and killed one of our family members. But what is the difference between the gazelle in the wilderness and a human primate in your apartment complex? They both weigh the same. The gazelle has more body hair and it can run faster. On the other hand, your family member has a bigger brain, walks upright, and can operate a remote control. While these two obviously have some physical and behavioral differences, what is the moral difference between them? One atheistic comedian explains, "How come when it's us, it's an abortion, and when it's a chicken, it's an omelet?" If you are offended at this joke, then you have understood the point. Of course, we would never tell this joke to a woman who recently had a miscarriage, asking her if she likes the comparison. And yet, under a naturalistic worldview, what difference is there between a chicken fetus and a human being? Both are just physical organisms clawing for survival in a hostile universe. C.S. Lewis writes, "We call cancer bad, they would say, because it kills a man. But you might just as well call a successful surgeon bad because he kills cancer." Atheist Richard Carrier states that a human baby, quote, "has more value than any animal on earth, with the possible exception of adult apes or dolphins or perhaps elephants." Unlike the atheistic comedian above, Carrier is not trying to be funny. He's dead serious. And as strange as his perspective may seem to many of us, we have to admire him for being consistent with his atheistic worldview. Morality is the subject of what should or ought to be. However, if you are a naturalist, that is, you believe only in nature and nothing beyond it, then whatever is there is the way that it should or ought to be. But if everything in nature is only natural, then how can a naturalist call murder, rape, or genocide unnatural? These immoral acts are perfectly normal in a naturalistic universe, just as natural as the rain falling or the wind blowing. Consider a little kid looking out the window on a summer day, frowning and saying, "It shouldn't be raining today." It wouldn't make any sense to criticize nature for allowing it to rain. Either it is raining or it isn't. There is no use saying the weather should or shouldn't be a certain way. In nature, whatever is there is right. For this reason, it is difficult for an atheist to make this giant leap from an is to an ought. For instance, a scientist can tell me what is the case, but she cannot tell me what ought to be the case. Put another way, a scientist can certainly prove that humans are more complicated than other animals, but she cannot prove that we are more valuable. Morality from evolution. Some atheists try to derive morality from our inherited evolutionary instincts. For instance, atheist Peter Singer explains, "Research on other primates shows that they have basic notions of fairness." Likewise, atheist Franz De Waal explains, "Mammals may derive pleasure from helping others in the same way that humans feel good doing good." However, far from being a sufficient explanation for morality, the alleged presence of animal morality only further articulates the problem. While animals are obviously capable of acting sacrificially, they are also capable of ripping each other limb from limb. It doesn't matter if they are capable of certain behaviors. It matters if they are culpable for them. Basing morality on animal behavior confuses description with prescription. While it's easy to describe certain behaviors in the animal kingdom, this is different than prescribing these same behaviors for humans. For instance, when a chimp throws feces at another chimp, we might laugh or take a picture, but we would never make it morally mandatory for human beings to mimic. However, it's easy to see that basing morality on primate behavior presupposes that one behavior is good, worth mimicking, and another is bad, worth avoiding. In other words, when we claim that morality comes from chimpanzees, we are already affirming that some behaviors are right and others are wrong. That is, we are not just observing certain behaviors. Instead, we are approving of them. Atheist Richard Dawkins argues, "An intelligent couple can read their Darwin and know that the ultimate reason for their sexual urges is procreation, yet they find their sexual desire is in no way diminished by the knowledge. I am suggesting that the same is true of the urge to kindness, to altruism, to generosity, to empathy, to pity. It is just like sexual desire. We can no more help ourselves feeling pity when we see a weeping unfortunate than we can help ourselves feeling lust for a member of the opposite sex. Both are misfirings, Darwinian mistakes. If our moral and sexual urges are really, quote, programmed into our brains, as Dawkins argues, then what happens if a sadistic urge overpowers a sacrificial one? Mother Teresa had a certain set of urges programmed into her, but then again, so did men like Ted Bundy or Jeffrey Dahmer. Which programmed urges were right and which were wrong? Of course, our urges aren't always in line with what is moral and immoral. For these reasons, evolutionists typically recant on this moral model when pressed. Morality from culture. Other atheistic thinkers try to derive objective morality from cultural norms. For instance, humanist Paul Kurtz writes, "The foundation of moral conduct are the human moral decencies, that is, the general moral virtues that are widely shared by humans of diverse cultural and religious backgrounds." However, this foundation for morality doesn't suffice, because some cultural values are clearly wrong. For instance, consider the Etoro ethnic group of Papua New Guinea. This culture has a very interesting view of sexual morals between men and boys. In fact, they believe that the older men in the society pass on their quote-unquote life force to the younger boys through oral sex. In fact, these young men are encouraged to give oral sex to the older men so they can grow up and become big and strong. In our society, we have names for men who trick young boys into giving them oral sex. We call them, quote-unquote, child molesters. We pay armed men to hunt these guys down and put them in prisons where they can never see the light of day and never get their hands on another person's child. Even prisoners in our culture look down on men like this. Yet in the Etoro culture, it is perfectly moral. In fact, it is encouraged. Now, there are two ways of looking at this cultural anecdote. You can either believe that it proves that morality is relative, or you can believe that it proves that morality is objective. Someone might hear this story and say, "Well, I guess this shows that every culture has equally valid moral beliefs." While this is one interpretation, I don't think this argument is strong enough to persuade me that this practice is just as moral as any other. In fact, I'm willing to bet that you feel the same way. To demonstrate this, I'd point out that you'd probably never send your son to the Etoro ethnic group as an exchange student so that he could learn the culture. I wouldn't either. Those men can keep their life force to themselves. Morality from empathy? Some atheistic thinkers argue that we derive objective morality from empathy. Atheist Peter Singer explains, "If we want to know if something's right or wrong, we ought to put ourselves in the position of all those affected by our action." However, while empathy does lead to understanding a person's pain, it does not necessarily serve as a basis for doing anything about it. This is a good example of the is versus ought distinction mentioned earlier. Empathy helps us learn what is the case. In essence, the person is in pain. But it doesn't command us what ought to be the case. In essence, I ought to help them. For example, a torturer understands the pain of his victims, probably more than most people do. However, this doesn't lead him to do anything compassionate for his victims. If empathy really means compassion, then Singer is arguing in a circle. This would be like saying, "We should be compassionate, because it is the compassionate thing to do." Morality from social contracts. Other atheists claim that we can derive morality from social contracts. Social contracts are, "you scratch my back and I'll scratch yours" agreements between two parties. However, these don't lead to objective morality either. Even atheist Elizabeth Anderson explains that the authority of a social contract, quote, is of course not absolute. One person might create a social contract to kill his neighbor, but what if the neighbor never agrees to this social contract? Is he still bound to what the contract says, even if he didn't agree to it? Under this view, he's not. Imagine calling the cops on a wife beater, only to find that the man had never signed a social contract stating that he would never beat his wife. If morality is truly objective, then it is binding over people, whether or not they agree to it. Morality from maximal happiness. Some of the so-called new atheists argue that maximizing happiness should be our foundation for morality. Atheist Richard Dawkins writes, "The greatest happiness of the greatest number is the foundation of morals and legislation." Likewise, atheist Sam Harris writes, Questions of right and wrong are really questions about the happiness and suffering of sentient creatures. However, in response, we might ask, why should we think that the flourishing of the human species is the ultimate good? Why not the flourishing of a race of beetles or baboons or bacteria? What makes humans so important? Moreover, while maximizing human happiness and reducing suffering are usually moral, they aren't always. For instance, imagine if 7 different people were dying in a hospital because they were waiting on organ transplants. One person needed a heart, another a kidney, another a liver. All 7 would die if they did not receive a transplant. Under this view, wouldn't it make sense to capture a healthy young man in the lobby to harvest his organs, the 7 organs the dying people needed, to maximize happiness for the 7 others? If you killed him, you would be saving 7 people. But if this view is true, then it wouldn't simply be morally permissible to kill the man in the waiting room. It would be morally mandatory. Yet this scene seems like it would fit better in a horror movie than in a flawless moral system. On a global scale, some argue that we could maximize human happiness by executing the mentally handicapped and the elderly. If we reallocated these humanitarian resources to problems like world hunger, disease, or education, we could maximize happiness for more people. But, like me, I'm sure you see that this is not a good solution. Instead, it sounds a lot more like Hitler's final solution. Clearly, maximal happiness cannot be our foundation for objective morality. Morality isn't always clear. Some atheists argue that morality cannot be objective because it isn't always clear. For instance, is it right to torture a psychopathic criminal for information if it meant saving hundreds of innocent lives? Is it always wrong to pull the plug on a 95-year-old man who is in extraordinary pain? Should we give foreign aid to refugees in one country or to orphans in another? Ethical dilemmas like these demonstrate that right and wrong aren't always clear. However, this argument doesn't invalidate objective morality either. Instead, these dilemmas merely demonstrate that the right moral action is unknown. While we might not know the right moral action, we still know that one must exist. Otherwise, there would be no use pondering the question. Why would we feel torn over these dilemmas if objective morality were simply an illusion? In determining whether morality exists, it's helpful to begin with the black and white moral issues before moving into the gray areas. For instance, ask yourself, is it wrong to rape women for pleasure? Is it wrong to torture babies for fun? Is it wrong to hunt humans for sport? When we begin with these moral extremes, we find that the answers to these questions are obvious. Therefore, as in any other discipline, we should begin with the clear before we move to the unclear. The unavoidable conclusion. Many atheistic thinkers will openly admit that morality is not objective in a universe without God. If you're going to be a consistent atheist, you need to get cozy with this fact. For instance, atheist Ayn Rand writes, "Now there is one word, a single word, which can blast the morality of altruism, in essence, sacrificially loving others, out of existence, in which it cannot withstand. The word, why? Why must man live for the sake of others? Why must he be a sacrificial animal? Why is that the good? There is no earthly reason for it." Most moralists and few of their victims realize that reason and altruism are incompatible. Rand is asking why she should live sacrificially for the good of another person if this is not in her own self-interest. Likewise, atheist Richard Dawkins writes, "It is pretty hard to defend absolutist morals on grounds other than religious ones." Furthermore, atheistic ethical philosopher Kai Nielsen writes, "If anybody is asking for any kind of absolutism, in essence, objective morality, I think they're just kidding themselves. Critical modernity has knocked that out, and post-modernity doesn't even attempt to restore it." If the Christian God exists, then morality would be based on his moral nature, and his moral imperatives would be necessary expressions of his moral character. On this basis, we would have a foundation for objective moral values, duties, and accountability. However, if there is no moral standard beyond the universe, and we know that there is no source of morality within it, then how can we still have morality? I think these atheistic thinkers are right. If God is dead, then so is objective morality. Number 4, free will. Can consciousness and free will exist in a universe without God? If there is no God, then everything in our universe is simply the product of cause and effect. Planets don't choose to rotate. Unsupported objects don't choose to fall to the earth. Rain clouds don't choose to form over a dry countryside. Nature simply causes these things to occur. But if everything in nature were a result of cause and effect, then this would mean that humans are also simply the product of cause and effect. Agnostic Stephen Hawking writes, "The molecular basis of biology shows that biological processes are governed by the laws of physics and chemistry, and therefore as determined as the orbits of the planets. So it seems that we are no more than biological machines, and that free will is an illusion." And yet, this raises a problem for the atheistic thinker. If everything in the universe is the result of cause and effect, then this must mean that even our choices are the result of cause and effect. Even our own thoughts and decisions would just be the result of a physical process in motion. We might feel like we have free thoughts and decisions, but this would simply be an illusion in the hardwiring of our conditioned brains. As C.S. Lewis wrote, "If thought is the undesigned and irrelevant product of cerebral motions, what reason have we to trust it?" All of us feel like we have our own ideas, thoughts, feelings, and will. But if everything in the universe is determined, then this is simply an illusion. If everything in the universe is physical, and therefore just physics, then why wouldn't we classify our brains as simply a physical organism that is determined to pump out thoughts like our heart pumps out blood? As one atheistic thinker colorfully explains it, the brain secretes thought as the liver secretes bile. Consider, for example, mixing baking soda and vinegar. This chemical reaction produces CO2. No matter how many times we mix the combination, it still produces the same chemical reaction. From the naturalistic point of view, our brains are just a myriad of chemical reactions, similar in principle to the baking soda and vinegar, which are responding to the stimulation of their central nervous system in the five senses. Thus, under this view, we are not really controlling our brains. Our brains are controlling us. The reactions of the brain are certainly more complex than baking soda and vinegar, but more complex reactions do not create free will. For instance, imagine setting up 10 dominoes in a row, watching them as they knock each other over. Now imagine if you set up 50,000 dominoes in a wide, complicated maze. Of course, this would surely be more complex, but not any more free. A supercomputer is complex, but it is not free to choose. It is determined based on its programming. Other naturalistic thinkers argue that our brains respond randomly to the five senses in the central nervous system. But random reactions do not create free will either. For example, a computer program might randomly select numbers, but this doesn't imply freedom to choose. Atheist Susan Blackmore admits, "The addition of truly random processes to a determined world, as in radioactive decay or quantum physics, does not provide a loophole for free will, since these processes, if they are truly random, cannot be influenced at all." To put it simply, free will involves intentional action, while randomness and complexity only involve reaction. Free will can only exist if we have a free-choosing component that exists outside of the cause and effect, or if you prefer, random, universe. And yet, if nothing exists outside of the universe, then free will is impossible. Atheistic thinkers are all too aware of this uncomfortable consequence of atheism. Leonid Perlovsky of Harvard writes, "The reconciliation of scientific causality and free will remains an unsolved problem." Atheist J.L. Mackey explains, "We ordinarily have an illusion of the literally immediate fulfillment of some of our own intentions. This is even a useful illusion." He admits, "We are stuck with some kind of dualism. The mind-body gap must be bridged somewhere and somehow." How is it bridged? He has absolutely no answer as a naturalist. He writes that it is simply a quote-unquote brute fact. Atheistic Nobel laureate Francis Crick writes, "The astonishing hypothesis is that you, your joys and your sorrows, your memories and your ambitions, your sense of personal identity and free will, are in fact no more than the behavior of a vast assembly of nerve cells and their associated molecules. In the conclusion to his book, Crick calls the human brain a complex machine that, quote, will appear to itself to have free will. And yet, this is simply an illusion. Atheist Susan Blackmore admits that despite our increasing understanding of the chemistry of the brain, the mystery of consciousness is, quote, as deep as ever. Reluctant to affirm a mind or soul that exists apart from the body, Blackmore writes that, quote, we may have to give up the idea that each of us knows what is in our consciousness now and accept that we might be deeply deluded about our own minds. Later, she writes, since the traditional theories lead only to confusion, it is worth taking seriously the idea that vision is a grand illusion. As a vehement atheist, Blackmore objects to the idea of a soul because this would imply magic, as she called it. She writes, if consciousness is conceived of as a force that makes free will possible, then it amounts to magic, an impossible intervention in an otherwise causally closed world. But if consciousness is not such a force, then our feelings of having conscious control must be an illusion. At this point, you might be thinking that this is all nonsense. If we are merely determined biological machines, then everything we do or think is just an illusion. If determinism is true, and these atheists are right, then life would become absurd. There would be no point in you listening to this book, or me reading it, because our brains would be determined to do so. There would be no use in making the statement, our decisions are determined, because this itself would be the result of a determined process. When someone cuts you off on the freeway, there is no use cussing them out. He was determined to do it. Have you ever stuck your foot in your mouth and felt bad about it? Don't feel bad. It's only an illusion that you had the choice to say anything in the first place. It was a grand illusion every time you made a decision, regretted a decision, or even felt that your decisions were in your control. I'm sure you might be thinking that these people have all lost their minds in believing something so absurd. And yet, if these atheistic thinkers are right, then they never had minds to begin with, only a collection of neurons firing in the brain. Therefore, according to their own view, calling them mindless wouldn't be an insult. It would be a statement of fact. Is it possible to have consciousness and free will in an atheistic universe? I don't see how, and neither do they. Conclusion. If atheism is true, then significance, equality, morality, and free will fall apart without a foundation. The more consistently you lived with this atheistic view, the less content you would become. The more content you found yourself, the more you'd realize how inconsistently you were living with your atheism. How do we solve this desperate dilemma? Should we persevere bravely with unyielding despair, as some atheistic thinkers have suggested, despite this pessimistic outlook? Should we believe in God just because it helps us sleep at night? Are there good reasons to infer that God is actually there to solve our dilemma? Or is this just wishful thinking? It is to these questions that we now turn.